Hello, I'm Jane Crowther, Editor-in-Chief of Total Film, and welcome to Inside Total Film, the weekly podcast from the Smarter Movie Magazine. And today I'm joined by our contributing editor and our columnist, Leila Lateef.
Hello.
Hello.
Good to be back.
Yes. The last time we saw each other, Leila, we were on a water taxi chugging up the Grand Canal in Venice.
Yeah. Good end to what was a good festival in the end. Great movies.
Yes, indeed. Okay, wonder if we've got great movies this week, because this week we are talking to Gareth Edwards about The Creator, and we'll be rating that, as well as horror franchiser Saw X, Saw 10, Saw X, I don't know, sexual politics thriller Fair Play, and Wes Anderson's short, The Wonderful Story of Henry Sugar. But before we get onto that, have you been watching anything else, Leila?
I've been watching some very jolly programming on TV. Sydney's icon Hamza, who won Strictly last year, has got a really lovely documentary series about nature, which is just like dopamine to the brain. And Bake Off is back. So I've been sitting down with a bit of cake and watching some Bake Off. And Alison Hammond is just such a perfect choice to be on that show, I think.
We often see her in junkets, don't we? Because she often does the interviews with the famouses for This Morning. And you can hear her laugh in any building that you're in. You know she's in the building if she's there. I've been catching up on Sex and the City season 2. Bit of a hate watch, obviously. It's not essential, but it's very easy to watch. And Aidan's back. And yeah, I don't really know who it's for, this show, really, anymore. I don't think it's for me anymore, and I don't know who it is actually for, because it's so completely unrealistic. But I just enjoy watching them, you know, wear their insane heels everywhere they go, and their outfits and their funny hats and everything else that's going on. So that's what I've been watching. It's just easy watching.
The original Sex and the City, or the second series of Just Like That?
Sorry.
Sex and the City story, or whatever it is.
I said Sex and the City, but I meant And Just Like That, but I just call it Sex and the City. Did you watch it?
I did. I really liked a couple of the new characters, but it was just so overstuffed that like none of them got more than like, I don't know, 3 minutes an episode. And I was like, well, you know, this woman seems really cool, but I don't know anything about her. And you know, there's that like that kind of professor whose only storyline is that she's just, at one point she gets a promotion. And aside from that, she's just kind of shagging people on Tinder. And it's like, okay, yes. This seems like a bit of a waste of this actress's time.
Yes. But yeah. It's easy though, isn't it? It's easy. And that's what we need right
pretty.
Now. Yeah. And that's what
we
need.
I think they all got too rich. It was a bit weird.
Yes, indeed. Well, shall we move on though? On to the future that is perhaps quite bleak. AI is in the news so much right now. I mean, when we're talking about strikes, it's one of the key things that is an issue for both the writers and the actors. What does AI do to your career, to your livelihood, to your industry? And this one gets into that as well.
Did you locate the weapon?
Yeah, it's just a kit.
Are you going to heaven?
No. You gotta be a good person to go to heaven.
So, we're the same. We can't go to heaven because you're not good. And I'm not a person.
Do you have any idea what the thing is?
She looks like a little girl now, but she's growing. Whoever has that kid wins the war.
Whose side do you want, huh?
So this is Gareth Edwards' latest, a future world where AI that was built to protect man has detonated a nuclear bomb and made all AI robots the enemy. But what happens when John David Washington's ruthless soldier is tasked with finding and destroying the ultimate robot weapon and then discovers that it's a little girl? Before we talk about the film, let's listen to what Gareth Edwards had to say about following up Rogue One with another sci-fi when he sat down with Jamie Graham this week to discuss it.
What do you want, sweetie?
For robots to be free.
Oh, we don't have that in the fridge. How about ice cream?
So Gareth, the last few years, well, the last few months, all we've heard about is AI, AI, AI. But I understand you started writing this in 2018. So how were you so ahead of the curve?
Oh, I mean, it was just part of the master plan, right?
Like, you know, anyone could see it coming. No, I was a total fluke. I just wanted to do a robot movie, ultimately. Like, I'd done a space movie and an alien film, if you want to call it that. And the last sort of part, you know, the great trinity of science fiction, all that was left was doing robots. And so I was just looking for the right idea. And I happened to get invited by Jordan Voight Roberts to Vietnam, because that's where he did the King Kong movie. And I was thinking of a robot film as I was spending the whole time there. And you see that imagery that, you know, to me, obviously I experienced Vietnam prior to that through films like Apocalypse Now. And you start looking at Buddhist monks and paddy fields and picturing robots and science fiction. And I just got really excited. Like, I've not seen that in a film. Like James Cameron took the Vietnam War and put it in space with aliens and maybe Avatar. And the idea of taking science fiction and bringing it down to Vietnam, I was like, okay, that's something I've not seen on my Blu-ray shelf. Like, you're always looking for that gap. Like, there's very few left. It was like, I think that could, there could be a movie in that.
You mentioned Apocalypse Now. I mean, watching this movie, you kind of, there's Apocalypse Now, there's Blade Runner, there's a bit of Star Wars in there. You take all these references which you grew up with, but you very much make it your own thing. I mean, were you a child, a wide-eyed child in front of a TV just watching endless movies?
Yeah, I think I'm bad because I watch the same films over and over. Like, there are film buffs and fans and filmmakers that watch a different movie every day or whatever they do. And I always feel guilty because I watch my favorite films a million times. And so it's really hard, you know, just like if someone talks to you in Spanish all your life, as you're growing up, you speak Spanish. When I got a chance to make a movie, I sort of speak the vocabulary of those films. And it's hard not to half the time, you know, like half the battle with this film was like for it not to be like Star Wars. You know, we'd do designs with James Klein, who worked on Star Wars, and we'd have to stop ourselves sometimes and go, we can't do that. That's too much like Ralph McQuarrie or someone, and Sid Mead in Blade Runner. And like, it's trying to hold back because they're so influential.
It's very much, I mean, watching the movie, it feels like those 1970s and 1980s sci-fi films, and it's got that sense of wonderment. It's got a lot of heart and emotion. I mean, is that very much what kind of floats your boat?
Yeah, I kind of was paranoid this might be the last film I ever get to make. And so I was like, I went round the supermarket and chucked every DVD I could in the trolley and then took it into the kitchen to kind of cook a dish. You can say it's homage or whatever, but it's a love letter to those films. And I miss that kind of film from cinema at the moment. It's like we've got into this little habit of being stuck with franchises and sequels and IP and everything. And so I was just, it was like a last ditch attempt to try and get that kind of movie back if I could do it.
Now, I understand you shot this movie almost like back to front in a way, that you went out, real locations, real actors, extras, you shot it all, and then you kind of added the effects and weaved it in and changed certain people into robots. So tell me about that process.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny because when you say that, like, effects are always done at the end, you know, visual effects. So it sounds like, well, that's the same as every movie, right? What was different was normally what happens is you design the film first. So you do a load of concept art. Based on a script or an idea. You show that to the studio and then everyone starts chasing those images. And typically the images are so like extreme that you can't go in. There's no place that looks like that. We're going to have to build it in a soundstage and probably shoot the rest against blue screen. So very quickly you end up in this situation that's very contrived. No one wins. It's very hard for VFX to do. The actors don't like it. I don't like it. I did a load of concept art, but I was like, but it's not going to literally be these images. Like, you're not going to actually get this image. It's the idea of this image. Let us go away, shoot it in the best locations in the world that we can find for each scene, and then we'll even edit the whole thing. And then when we sort of know what shots are in the movie, then we'll do the design work. And so the advantage of that is you can riff off the foreground that's naturally there that you couldn't have anticipated. Like James Klein, who did a lot of the design on this, we would always wait. We never designed anything until we had the shot, because if we were trying to do some crazy, like monolithic sci-fi structure in the background, if we actually designed it first and then stuck it in, it feels stuck in. So we would look at architecture that was in the mid-ground and in the actual buildings, and then we would copy paste and stretch and blend that architecture into the crazy thing we were adding, so that when the audience watches it, they can't quite figure out where it ends and begin, like where the divide is. because it's like, well, that must be real, that shape, and then, but that can't, and that definitely can't be, and everyone gets confused, and it's a cheap trick, and it's cheaper to shoot that way. It was more creative. Everything about it was better. I wouldn't go back to the previous way of making a film.
And why John David Washington? He's so good in this movie. Why did you go for him? And is it true he turned up for your first meeting in a Star Wars mask in COVID times?
He did, yeah. He walked in. We were in it was actually a really fancy restaurant. Neither of us picked it. Some agents set it up. I'd never been there before. And it was like, he walked in and he had a Star Wars mask on. And I thought, oh no, here we go. Like, he sort of was embarrassed about it. And we took, I come to admit this now, right? But we took our masks off to have a conversation because we needed to get to know each other. And he sort of said, I've been wearing this for the last year and I thought about not wearing it for this meeting, but then it felt false. And so he's a very genuine person and an incredibly, like, you instantly really like him. Like, he's not got any aspect to him that you'd expect, you know, considering his background and everything. And so we just really hit it off. I wanted someone who was going to show vulnerability and not be like a man's man, like, but have cracks in the armor and be broken as a person and not be afraid to show all that. And on the drive home, Tenet was out, had just come out in the cinema during COVID. And I was driving back and every traffic light I stopped at, there was a billboard with John David on it looking at me or whatever. And it was like he was saying, you want me, right? You know, and then after the 10th billboard, I was like, all right. And so I got home and just called up the studio and was like, yeah, let's do it.
So do you think this movie is going to change anything in Hollywood? That I was watching it and it looks and feels like a $250 million movie, but the way you went out and shot it, often with a guerrilla team for certain scenes, you obviously made it for a lot less than that. Do you think Hollywood would now think, why are we spending $250 million on these movies?
You would like to think so, wouldn't you? But I don't think it's going to do anything. I think there'll be a little like, why are we spending $250 million on a movie? And then someone comes in with a spreadsheet and that's the end of the conversation. That's why. Look at the spreadsheet. You know, and I've had those conversations. I've been on films going, why are we spending this much? And they go through it line by line. And one line at a time, it all makes sense. But as a whole, you go, but why? And it's like a machine. It's like a factory. It's really hard to change things. I mean, maybe there's tools around the corner, AI tools, that will, you know, reduce the cost of filmmaking. Who knows? I don't want to go back. When you say $80 million, that's a hell of a lot of money, right? That's nothing to be that proud of. It wasn't 80 million when we were trying to make it. Like, the pandemic pushed it up. But let's say it was 80, right? I said to the team, no one on our film can ever say this sentence. I don't want to ever hear it. We cannot do that because we only have $80 million, right? Like, you can fly anywhere in the world for like a couple of thousand dollars or so, right? That means we can go anywhere, we can do anything. It's like everything is affordable at that level. It's a crazy amount of money. Like, it made the first film ever made for 250 grand. And so the idea of having 80 million, like, it should be Star Wars times 100. You know what I mean? Like, I'm actually embarrassed that it was that much money because it's a hell of a lot.
So how did you reduce the costs? I mean, for our listeners, what did you do? Because you actually went out, didn't you, to these far-flung locations, various countries, just you and a guerrilla team, and you shot amazing scenery?
I think one reason, you know, some people have kind of said things nice about, like, they call it the world building of the film. And the sort of confession is that we didn't build any world. We just went to the world and pressed record. Like, it's all out there. And all we did, it's like, you know, the George Lucas, you know, example is like, you just change 20, 30%. That's all you need to do. If you change 100%, obviously you're in Avatar territory, you know, and it's going to cost a fortune. But if you're just sticking it in, and mainly, we tried to go, it wasn't totally true, but we tried to have this idea of like the immediate 50 meters or more is in camera. And it's only the really distant stuff. And if you picture it, like, the distant stuff is a Photoshop painting. You know, really, that's probably the cheapest thing in the world to do. So it can look like a crazy amount of expense, but it's actually the opposite half the time.
You made Monsters in a similar way to how you made this film. In between, you made Godzilla and you made Rogue One, sort of huge sci-fi films. Is this the kind of film you want to make now, where it feels almost a bit independent, but also a huge studio movie all mishmashed together?
I grew up with Spielberg and Kubrick and everybody, and they do very considered storytelling most of the time. You know, not there's examples of other stuff, but you know, very like dolly moves and like oneers, you know, where they, you know, they do these very brilliantly choreographed scenes. And then there's this other part of me that likes this very guerrilla kind of documentary-esque, like completely improvised thing. I always struggled with how to marry those two aesthetics. And I think this film, more than anything else I've done before, like, because Monsters, as much as I like that film, it's missing that cinema, that like dolly shot cinema, if you want to call it that. And vice versa, you know, Godzilla is missing the kind of cinema verite of Monsters and things like this. And I think this is the sweetest, closest to the bullseye that I've done for myself. But it's like being a gambler making a movie. Like, you just leave the casino and you want to go straight back in because you're like, oh, now I know how to win, right? Like, now, next time I'm gonna win the roulette because I know how to do it.
So now you know how to win, will there be Creator 2? Will that be the smack on bullseye?
No, because it's like my girlfriend, when we get a little moment together and we decide to watch something, we spend half of the time we've got arguing about what it is we're going to watch. And she always wants to watch some streaming TV show that, you know, that everyone's talking about. And I want to watch a movie. And at one point she was like, what's your problem with TV? You know, and I had to think about it because I don't gravitate to television. And I realized, oh, it's my favorite part of a story is the ending. I like endings, and TV goes on and on and on. And it's like my favorite part of a joke is the punchline. And so it's like this, trying to design a story or a film, like the best movies in my mind, things like Reservoir Dogs or E.T. or whatever, there's this hard cut to credits right at the end, and you suddenly wake up and you're out of the dream and you go, whoa, and you realize you were just in a trance, you know what I mean? And I love that mic drop ending to a film where it snaps you out of it and everything's working backwards to that moment for me. So no, there's no sequel.
So that was Gareth Edwards talking to Jamie Graham. Layla, you and I went to see this last night, didn't we? At a Fancy Pants UK premiere at the Science Museum, complete with cocktails with bubbles and, you know, planes strung from the ceiling and spaceships and the like. But did the venue match up to the film? Tell us about the film.
Yeah, I mean, the venue was amazing. What a place to go and see it. And I managed to get a lovely cake pop, which was in the shape of a globe. But so, yeah, expectations were pretty high because we were quite hyped going in. And the film, I think, did meet up to those kind of lofty location and fancy canapes. Yeah, it's sort of set in a future not too far in the distance. I think they specify like 2065.
Yeah.
But essentially AI has gotten to the point where they're sort of humanoids. And in America, there's been a bomb which they blame on the AI. So all of AI has been completely outlawed, but they're sort of still living quite happily in harmony with people in East Asia. Our main character is played by John David Washington, who plays Joshua. He's in a relationship with Gemma Chan, a woman called Maya, who's another human, but she is very much supportive of the AI and believes that they can all live in harmony. He's actually, it turns out, an undercover agent. This isn't a spoiler. This is all the first few minutes.
Yeah, yeah.
And things go badly wrong. Cut forward 5 years, and he's sort of, you know, dragged in for one last mission to kind of finally wipe the scourge off AI. Off the planet, but it's very like, are we the bad guys really? Sort of vibes. And he's got a lot of moral conflicts ahead of him.
Yeah, it's very District 9 in that respect, where it asks who is the aggressor and who are the sort of the more human, in quote marks, race in this, isn't it? It's world building. You know, Gareth is a man who created an amazing film in Monsters with very little money. And this he's done for $80 million. It doesn't look like 80 million. It looks like 200 million on screen. So he's done this amazing job of creating this world. But does the narrative stand up? Because for me, I really loved what he did. And I'm really glad that this exists as a film, because it's, you know, it's not IP that currently exists. This is original. It's a mid-budget sci-fi. It's somebody who's a filmmaker going to a studio and saying, I'd like to do this, instead of the other way around. It feels less sort of processed in that way, sort of packaging up the meat and sending it out. But it didn't quite live up to my expectations in terms of narrative. I felt it was very similar to a lot of stuff I'd seen. Armageddon's in there, District 9, Blade Runner,
Avatar.
A lot of Avatar, a lot of Rogue One. I mean, it's very much Rogue One story sort of reskinned for me. So in that respect, I found it a little bit obvious what was going to happen. How did you feel?
Even though a lot of it was the sort of thing that we've seen many times before, and I would say the science side of it is quite low in terms of sci-fi. It doesn't explain a lot in terms of exactly how this technology works and how these different things have been developed. But I quite liked that about it, that I wasn't getting like giant dumps of exposition. And yeah, some of the twists you can see 10 miles off. You can see them from the trailer.
Don't watch the trailer, guys.
But some of it I thought was went quite a lot darker than I was expecting. Yeah, there's some pretty surprisingly sad and tragic and just like really grim moments. I think there's always that thing when you're kind of doing war, especially like big futuristic war, of like trying to make it, you kind of want it to look great, but it doesn't look too like awesome in this. Like you, when you have these like big battle scenes, he really does like linger on like, oh no, people are dying.
Yeah.
And isn't that awful? And every single loss is like being felt. So yeah, I mean, not reinventing the wheel. I think it probably has benefited a lot from the fact that June was delayed, as this being like our big kind of autumn action sci-fi, kind of that is for grown-ups. But I'd say I had a really good time at the movies.
Let's talk about the kid then, Alfie, who is who comes along into the story, and John David Washington's character Joshua finds this child that is an AI child, played by Madeline Una Voiles. For me, a lot of the emotion of this film hangs on this child's performance, and she knocks it out the park for me. She did all the heavy lifting on this for me. This is a very sentimental film. You know, you're saying it's about war and everything. It is about war and how horrible it is and how terrible we are to each other and how nations and races and all sorts of, you know, things go against each other, and on that, this urge to eradicate, and that we in war, we make people to be one mass that should be just wiped out, and they're not individuals. So he does a good job of that. But equally, this kid is bringing this sort of emotional feels, and there's a lot of moments that I felt were quite almost Armageddon, strike up the Aerosmith tune, don't want to hold, you know, like it felt a little bit manipulative in that way. But I thought she was incredibly authentic. And there's a particular line about heaven and who goes to heaven and who gets to go to heaven that is a refrain that sort of plays throughout this film, that when she delivered this particular line just really got me. I thought she was great. Did you?
Yeah, I mean, I'm really getting like slightly tearful just thinking about that heaven line. Oh yeah. I mean, I guess it's that whole thing of like, in order for this to work, you need Joshua to fall so quickly in love with this child. And I was just right there with him. She does play a little bit into the sort of roboticness of the character, but not too much. And she does end up kind of feeling almost like the most human person that's appeared on screen. Yeah, I just thought she was really, really stunning. And, you know, child performances, that is not always assured.
No. John David, I mean, I feel like his character is very sort of not massively fleshed out, and that this girl's performance gives him the humanity that's lacking on the page. And together they have a particular scene, no spoilers, you know, in a sort of hospital environment that is truly affecting. I think just I probably would have wanted more of that subtlety there to, written large across the whole of the film for me.
I think that's a very fair criticism. I mean, I would say that I thought John David Washington and Gemma Chan did quite a good job of making me like believe in their love with actually not much screen time together.
With just a white dress and paddling in a beach, basically. Yeah. That's what they had to work with.
And, you know, if you can't fall in love whilst, you know, in a beautiful tropical beach in a white dress as, you know, John David Washington sweeps you around and you paddle in the surf. I mean, yeah, I'd fall in love with anyone, I think, in that scenario. I mean, Alison Janney, Ken Watanabe, I think Alison doesn't really do a great job. They're sort of like basically leading figures from opposing sides, him being on the AI side, her being on the American imperialism side. I didn't think she was great. I think she sort of, no, I thought she kind of seemed to come out of a much like broader movie. I never really could get a handle on what was driving her. But I thought Ken was absolutely fantastic. I mean, what does it say about me that I just loved all the AI people way more?
But that's the point, I think. I think it's done its job. True. I think it's done its job because, you know, this movie does ask us to look at whoever we look at in our lives as sort of as non-mattering. And that kind of any person that goes to cinema that just thinks, oh, I hate that kind of person or whatever, and says, but do you know them? And are you thinking about them properly? And so from that point of view, I think it would appeal to anybody. But I really liked Allison Janney. I thought she was doing the same job that Edie Falco was doing in Avatar, The Way of Water.
I didn't like Avatar, so.
But she's representing, isn't she, this huge sort of industrial complex of military complex of America that is literally driving huge tanks through people's worlds and just destroying trees, houses, children, squashing anything in its path. And that's essentially what she is representing as an entire sort of section of people. So yeah, I think she's believable as a colonel. I totally believe she'd be strapping on the masts and going off through the cornfields to kill people.
I guess my issue is what I liked so much about it is, like, I got to halfway through this film and I wasn't entirely sure what even, like, most of the terms meant. And I liked that I was kind of figuring it out as it went along exactly how this world operates. But, like, with Allison Janney, it was just, like, a little bit less subtle because it's almost like they give... There's a scene right at the beginning when we get introduced to her where she goes, this is my character motivation, essentially. Yeah, yeah. And I was like, oh, she's thought that was
this
clumsy.
Is where I tell you a story and cry a single tear down my scarred face. And there you go. Off you go. You know where I am. That was a little clumsy. I can see that. But she was a good big bad. And she is representing the human face of this huge sort of technological thing, which, you know, this massive eye in the sky that they have, and then these huge tanks that are the size of buildings that are rampaging through the countryside. I think she did that job really well. The action's really good as well.
The action's really great, but also just in terms of, like, the American industrial complex leaders, it's really not his fault at all, but I can't look at Ralph Ineson without seeing Finchy from The Office.
I know. So they've dressed him in this, like, military suit and given him, like, these weird aviator glasses. And he's like, oh my God, you know, we've got to go. And all you could think is, how far can you throw a shoe over a building?
Yeah. And the poor guy, it's been like 20 years and he's done so many amazing things.
Yeah.
But, like, yeah, I don't know what to tell you. Finchy from The Office has really risen through the ranks.
Finchy. But again, he's playing an odious person, so it kind of works. So yeah, let's talk about the action and the special effects. And I think it's an amazing achievement because I totally believed that world. Did you?
Oh, 100%. I mean, it really goes to show you what actually using locations really does. I mean, not to compare everything about it to Dune, but it's that same thing of, like, if you go and you've gotten the light and you've gotten the feel and the texture, that cannot be replicated. You know, you can quadruple the budget, unless I think you've actually gone there. There's just something you didn't capture. And yeah, this world made perfect sense to me. I mean, it's not that far in the future, but, like, that whole, the futuristic elements with kind of, there's still paddy fields, all made perfect sense in, like, the temples that were incorporating new tech. I just, yeah, this is a gorgeous film and it is just so impressive. I mean, like, $80 million is a lot of money, but
yes,
it's not
it
for this type of movie.
Yeah. I mean, and you could have made this movie for many times more that and green screened the whole thing and it would have had that weird, shiny, sort of can't really sense it feeling about it, whereas this does feel tactile and visceral when you watch it. And I love, like, the details, like when you go into a temple where the AI have been sort of worshipping and they sort of have a sort of Buddhist sort of religion that they've created, that even in the temple it's really old and there's carved figures, but the carved figures that were might have been human are little droids in the walls and things. So the attention to detail in that sense is really great. And yeah, I think if you're looking for something original that isn't a book, hasn't been a comic, you know, isn't a TV show, isn't a reboot, this is good value for money at the cinema.
Yeah, no, I fully agree. I really hope people go out and see this one. Gareth Edwards is just, he's a really exciting director. I mean, he's kind of making crowd-pleasing movies, but he's just making them with intelligence and with style, and I loved quite a few of these performances. More Ken Watanabe in my world always, please.
Okay, so that is The Creator, and that is in cinemas on Friday. See it on a very big screen so you can really take in the majesty of that world that he's created. So it's time to move on then. It's time to get your tricycle out. It's this.
Hello everyone, It's time to play a game. You all pretended to cure me, but what I have planned for each of you is very real.
So this is Saw X. Layla, I mean, we've been around with this one numerous times. What's new?
Yeah, we've been backwards and forwards and simultaneous sequels, you know, everything that they've done to keep this franchise alive, to basically keep Tobin Bell's John Kramer slash the Jigsaw Killer alive. It's one of the issues when you start off with a franchise with a character who's only got months to live, and then it makes a ton of money and you want to keep making
it. Oh, no!
So this one is the 10th installment, hence the X, and it is set just after the events of Saw. It's not doing a full Halloween reboot, forget everything else that's happened, for reasons that I will not get into and a few twists that come, but it is kind of starting again. So it's essentially a sequel to Saw 1. So we are back in about 2004. The events of the first film, if you recall, is two men with a saw trapped in a disgusting room, and a killer is basically trying to encourage them to saw one of their feet off in order to escape, and it all goes horribly, horribly wrong. So at this point, that's just happened. Jigsaw is now seeking treatment for his terminal brain cancer. It's not going terribly well. And he gets offered to go on this like experimental trial treatment, which is a bit off the grid, but has gotten some very good results in Mexico under the care of this doctor, Norwegian doctor called Dr. Cecilia Pedersen. It's like a glorious genius ubermensch. And yes, sorry, I digress, but she was absolutely fantastic. So yes, when he gets there, as it is John Kramer, the Jigsaw killer, he finds some people morally wanting within Mexico, and he then decides, as he does, to trap them in some terrible traps and make them sort of realize the meaning of life if they can escape them.
So, I mean, one of the things about Saw that people enjoy is the ever-inventiveness of said traps. Are we going to be pleased with what's been cooked up here?
Yeah, I think so. There's a couple of like very wacky ones. There's one on the poster that people may have seen with like the tubes to the eyes. That's particularly whimsical. A lot of
whimsical isn't a word I've used with Saw.
Because this is, I suppose, supposed to be quite early on in Jigsaw's career. And if you think of the first Saw trap, that was quite a simple one. So this is more going a bit more back to basics, where it's a kind of, can you hack at this in order to get out sort of thing. But it's a very, very different tone, I think, from the first one and from the ones that have come before it. Because, I mean, I'm serious when I say I don't think I've heard laughter like it in a screening ever since like maybe Hitman, the new Linklater. It's so funny. And in only probably to kind of dark film critics who are able to laugh at such things, this one really, really leans into being a horror comedy. And it is really, really funny. I mean, yeah, there's some grace moments and there's some stuff where you might want to close your eyes and plug your ears, but absolutely hilarious. I had such a fun time.
Wow. So if you're a fan, is this going to be like a nice refresh to have a comedy element thrown in there? Or, you know, like, is it going to get new fans? What do you think it's going to do for this franchise?
I think this is for people that are established fans of Saw, because there are a lot of in-jokes. There's sort of people who appear that you have to know from a future sequel. It kind of expects you to already have quite a bit of affection for John Kramer. But I just think it's so amazing that in that first Saw, they essentially got Tobin Bell to be in one scene. He's barely talks in it. And then he turned out to be such a great actor. And he's fantastic in this. And he's really, really funny. But he's also like very convincingly evil at times and very convincingly kind at times. Like, you believe that he believes in his utterly mad mission that somehow torturing people is going to really help them.
Yeah, and that he's sort of helping people to see the error of their ways. He's not just torturing for no reason. There is a grand master plan into this. I'm kind of intrigued. So when I saw this and I saw it was number 10, I was like, eh. But actually, it sounds like they might have reinvented the wheel a little bit on this.
I would say this is probably the third best Saw movie.
Wow. What's your number one and two?
Number one and two.
Okay, fair enough. So let's go Saw 1 and 2 and then 10.
10, okay. Then 6, and then the rest of them are pretty rubbish. And then probably the worst was that spiral from the Book of Saw nonsense that Chris Rocker made. That was appalling.
Right.
This is just really good fun.
Well, you've convinced me. I'm going to go and get a ticket for this weekend because I've seen the creator. And I think if we're talking about big films to see with audiences, probably Saw and the creator are the ones that we want to send people to, right?
Yeah, I think so. It's actually a pretty good week all round. I mean, I've been pleasantly surprised by quite a few of these. The nights are drawing in. It's getting cold out. Time for people to get their behinds to the movies.
Yeah, and it's nearly Halloween. Well, getting into the Halloween season, so Saw X is perfect. If you fancy a bit of Saw X, it is in cinemas on Friday. Right, is all fair in love and war? Let's see with this.
So, what did he want?
He's promoting me.
Congratulations.
I'm sorry.
Why? I'm so happy for you. Okay.
Wonder how she got the fast pass. Reporting to her?
Jesus, man.
Look into this. Let me know what you think.
I'm still working on the 3 from before.
Okay, I'll make this one the priority. Can I buy another?
Now that you're making more money than me. Oh.
This is Fair Play. And Layla, you and I saw this at Sundance in January. It was a bit of a one that sort of people were getting excited about, one that we didn't sort of anticipate being one of the sort of films of the festival, but then the subject matter was quite juicy. Tell us a little bit about it.
It did seem to get a lot of attention, but it is basically about a couple played by Phoebe Dynevor, who I hope I'm pronouncing that right, but she's best known for being the lead in the first series of Bridgerton, and Alden Ehrenreich, who most people probably know as being Han Solo, but he's cropped up in a lot of other good stuff. And they are a couple, but both working in a hedge fund, which is incredibly cutthroat, but nobody at work knows that they are together. They are very kind of like happily living together and like seem to have a really loving and kind of quite a sexy relationship. As the film goes on, they're kind of competing for this one big promotion at the bank, and she gets it. I mean, that's not too much of a spoiler. This happens quite early on. And you just see the way that it sort of destroys their relationship, and she becomes increasingly cutthroat, and he becomes sort of increasingly insecure, and it has ramifications for the stuff at work, but it really mostly becomes like a real kind of power play toxic dynamic between the two of them.
It is sexy. It opens with them banging in a bathroom during an event, and sort of they get engaged, and it seems like everything's going to go well for them, and they're very evenly matched. They're both in the same business. They feel like they're absolute equals, and then this absolutely knocks his ego for 6. But also the firm has a no fraternizing policy. You're not supposed to be having relationships with people that you work with. It's sort of an undercover relationship because it's a troublesome thing. But then basically he cannot stand that she could become more successful. I really like this. Did you like this? Have you discussing aspects of it, toxic relationships, patriarchal sort of complex and sort of little man syndrome and everything else that's going on in it?
Yeah, no, I really, really like this one. I think it kind of I think when it was described as an erotic thriller, I didn't feel like that was quite right, because a lot of it is, I mean, some of it is sexy, but it's sort of a bit, it's not that erotic for a lot of it. And like where it ends up feels like quite distinctly like not sexy in places. But yeah, that whole cutthroat world of hedge funds, like it's just as kind of toxic a work environment in many ways as it is a relationship. But the two of them have like really, really great chemistry, and you do sort of believe in them being drawn to one another, even when it's all gone so wrong in other ways. And I sort of really admire Alden for taking a role like this, because at times he has to just be like deeply pathetic.
Yes.
In a way that I feel like most actors wouldn't necessarily want to have themselves on screen being.
Yeah, he's not heroic. You know, he is not a man who stands up for what is right. He is a man who will go with the flow. The scenes that I sort of found sort of the most truthful and that I could really relate to were scenes in which, you know, other men within the office were saying horrible things about her and how she might have got this promotion and why, and him having to him sort of going along with that and not at all standing up and saying, is that the right thing to say, guys? Should we be saying that? In no way does he put his head above the parapet. And that's a really interesting dynamic and one that I think a lot of people could relate to.
Yeah. I mean, some of the most horrible elements is just how she has to kind of go along with being part of like this boys club in so many plays. I mean, this just feels like the biggest argument for not going into finance.
I know, so along with dumb money. Dumb money makes you hate sort of Wall Street fat cats. This won't endear them to you either, will they?
I don't think that we need to kind of be reminded of that, because I mean, The Big Short did it as well. These are horrible, horrible environments where people are just out to get ahead and no loyalty to anything and no like real goals to accomplish anything aside from make money. Yeah, in the kind of months since, with all of these strikes and stuff, I think some of that has become even, you know, a bit more powerful. It feels very timely, even though we saw it 9 months ago. It feels very much like an end of 2023 film.
The situation that this character is in, Emily, the lead, although she works in this high power, high pressure, high stakes and high money environment, I think the situations that she's experiencing as a woman in a workplace can happen in any industry. And so from that point of view, it feels like, as you say, we're at a moment where we're actually questioning how we treat people. Generally, and what is right, and how we treat workers and how we treat women as well within that environment. So yeah, it feels very pertinent, but it's not preachy, I don't feel. You know, the thriller aspect of it is a thriller. You are taken along for the ride. It's highly entertaining. It's not sort of a take your medicine type of film. It is a fun watch, isn't it?
Yeah, really good fun. I did see a couple of reactions online at the time, which were like, oh, they're both as bad as each other. And I'm a bit worried that anybody could take that message from it, because that's not what I came away with.
No.
But yeah, no, they're both complicated people. They haven't made her like a saint in order to kind of make her like the perfect victim or anything like that, which I thought was great. And normally people are a bit disappointed when things are going straight to Netflix, but I think this is like a perfect Netflix film.
Yeah, it's a smart, sexy, sort of vital film, and not one that's sort of like one of those big action ones that you immediately forget. This one is one that you can sit down and watch and feel like you haven't just sort of burnt a hole in your brain by watching it. Also, shout out to Eddie Marsan in this. He plays this such horrible, oily boss who calls people down to his club at stupid o'clock at night to have discussions, and is absolutely fine with absolute implosions in his workspace and doing this New York accent. I don't think I've seen Eddie do that before and play such a loathsome character. So I really enjoyed that.
Yeah, I was quite surprised to see him, but like, yeah, it did work. It did work.
So yeah, if you like Eddie Marsan and you're used to seeing him be sort of like a sweet bumbling man, which is what he generally plays, this is quite a left turn. I really enjoyed that. So I think we're saying do watch this on Netflix when it's out, because it's a good one.
Yeah, believe the hype.
So Fair Play is in cinemas from Friday, limited, and then it streams on Netflix from the 13th of October. Final film now. It's short, but is it sweet? It's this.
Henry Sugar was 41 years old. Unmarried and rich.
Strange. The following is what Henry read in the Little Blue Exercise Book.
Gentlemen, I am a man who can see without using his eyes.
He saw it, I cried. He saw that trolley. This is absolutely unbelievable. I was flabbergasted.
This is a terrific piece of information. This could change my life.
An extraordinary thing happened.
All at once, he sees through his own skin. Like an X-ray, only better, he sees everything.
Henry was now almost certainly capable of making money faster than any other person in the entire world. Interesting.
So this is the wonderful story of Henry Sugar, Wes Anderson being so very Wes for, 41 minutes, I think it is exactly? It's a treat in terms of running time. What is it about? Obviously, it's Henry Sugar, but what's he up to, Layla?
Yes, it's based on a Roald Dahl collection of short stories. And it's basically Benedict Cumberbatch, who's playing the eponymous Henry Sugar, who's an incredibly rich man, but he's sort of decided, unlike the characters of Fairplay, that like money isn't everything. Like that's not what he's not going to devote his life to just accumulating more. So he learns about a guru who can see without using his eyes. And then he decides that he's going to kind of pursue where, like all the opportunities that that presents. Yeah, so it's Wes back with Roald Dahl again, because he previously did The Fantastic Mr. Fox. We've got some of his old favourites in, like, you know, Ralph Fiennes is in this. And then a couple of new people, which I think really suited his sort of aesthetic. Dev Patel, particularly. I think that needs to be a kind of collab that keeps happening again in the future. And Richard Ayoade plays two roles. But yeah, very short, very sweet. I'm pretty sure I've read this Roald Dahl short story, but I couldn't really remember it. But it's a perfectly lovely little thing. And I wasn't a massive fan of Asteroid City, and I found this a bit more fun.
Yeah. Yeah, I found Asteroid City extremely sort of plodding and so Wes in a way that was irritating. This is back to the sort of vibe of the Grand Budapest Hotel. It's frothy, it's a confection, it's got the sliding diorama, it's got people sort of wheeled in and wheeled out, it's got people changing wigs and moustaches and all talking to camera, and everybody talking in that very fast way that you absolutely have to when you're in a Wes Anderson film, and if you don't talk like that, then you can't be in it. And all of the people that are in this, from Cumberbatch to Dev Patel, are extremely good at doing that. So that sort of delightful bonbon effect that you're getting from Wes really works with those people. But it is very Wes. And there's so many filmmakers that do the same thing over and over again, and that's why we love it. And Wes has a very particular way of filming, a particular way of writing scripts, particular way of directing, and the people he puts in his film bend to his style and not the other way around. I know that that's very, very popular, but if you don't like that, this is going to be very grating, isn't it?
Yeah, Wes Anderson is not interested in doing anything aside from the Wes Anderson shtick. Yeah. Which for the most part I really like, but sometimes it does feel a bit style over substance. Like, I love the Royal Tenenbaum so much. I think that's like a perfect film. But yeah, I think sometimes it gets a little bit like you're watching a parody of Wes Anderson.
Yeah.
But I thought with this, because it is shorter and sweeter and kind of has a bit of that kind of childlike sense of wonder, it's got the Roald Dahl of it all, like Roald Dahl's humor, I think still kind of comes out of it, and his sort of spiky naughtiness that he had that made all of his kids' books so much fun. It works as a sensibility. I think there's going to be more of them, which I think would be quite fun as like a little collection being accumulated. But yeah, 40 minutes on Netflix, I mean, that's just pretty hard for anyone to turn down. I think it's really worth checking out. And yeah, more of this, less of the sort of ponderous nonsense of Asteroid City. I mean, at the time I felt like I'd gone mad because everybody around me but you seemed to really love it, and I just thought it was so boring.
I thought it was so boring and so pretentious. This one is really sort of buoyant and fun. It feels like he's having fun with this, and so you have fun watching it. And that the sort of conceit of people, so the different actors help each other out in changing their clothes, they play multiple roles, as you said, that sort of putting on a show and having fun aspect makes it just bounce along. It's totally inoffensive, I would say, unless you absolutely find this grating to the max. And yeah, and I loved the fact that it's got this bookend that is Ralph Fiennes as Roald Dahl sitting in his little writer's hut at his house. And if you've ever seen pictures of that hut, it's really very Wes Anderson to begin with, isn't it? It's sort of got this oversized armchair, and he used to sort of write all his stories sort of longhand with all these little trinkets in the background. So it's so perfect a fit for him. He basically doesn't have to Wes Anderson up Roald Dahl. He's already in that sort of vibe. So it really feels like a great fit. And as you say, it's supposed to be an anthology. He's going to do more. And I assume at some point when he's done a couple, then they will all be able to be seen together, and you would have it like the other films he's done that are sort of different stories woven together. But at the moment, it's just this on Netflix, and it's a delight. The whole family could watch this, and no one's going to be like, oh my goodness, what are we watching? It's very inoffensive on that level. And you can watch it and again, not feel like you've wasted your time, which is always a winner. I mean, we saw it in Venice, didn't we? And the thing that annoyed me most about that was that people were actually allowed into the screening half an hour into the film. And this was a 41-minute film. I would love to read the reviews of the critics that turned up to that film 30 minutes into a 40-minute film. What did they write about, and how could they possibly have any opinion on it? But that's just an aside. I think that Netflix this week has got two corkers, which is a bit of a change, because often we're talking about Netflix films that are just all explosions, loads of money thrown at the screen, and maybe not that memorable. And I think these two are actually really quality items that they have managed to put on their service that actually do speak to their sort of ambition to be a proper studio.
Yeah. And I mean, recently they got Hitmen. They just purchased that. That's going to be out on Netflix, which we saw at Venice, and just so fun and so funny. I mean, particularly now that they've that the sort of strike is coming to an end and that people are paying their actors, I feel like very guilt-free that I, as much as I love going to the cinema, seeing things on like giant screens, I can appreciate that like sitting down on the sofa with popcorn and like enjoying some movies in the comfort of your own home. I don't think like we have to act like that's some sort of, you know, like that doesn't have any value in itself.
Total value. It's expensive to go to the cinema. It can be an ask to get to the cinema. Netflix is an incredibly important sort of connective tissue for people who can't get there or can't afford to. And I love Is It Cake, another nonsense that Netflix has on their platform. And Love is Blind. Love that stuff. But equally really pleased to see this sort of thing on there as well.
Yeah, keep up the good work, and good for you for paying your writers, Netflix.
Yes, well done. Okay, so The Wonderful Story of Henry Sugar is on Netflix from Friday. Right, a reminder that if you like this podcast, you can make your life easier by subscribing. Just press the button now and you are all set. Okay, so that's all we have for this week. Layla, what's your film of the week? What are you sending people out to see to buy their popcorn for?
So this is a really tough one because it's really close.
All of them,
I like so
is the
much
answer.
About all of them. Probably The Creator. I would say of all of them, that is the one that will benefit the most from the big screen experience. And like, just to see how gorgeous the movie is, how good the action sequences are. But
and you're going to want to book a holiday, aren't you, as well? When you watch that as well, you'll be like, when can we go to Thailand on a nice holiday, please?
Definitely. But I would say don't sleep on Saw X, because it's a very fun communal experience. Sitting there laughing and kind of hiding behind your hands with other people. Really, really good fun.
Yeah, I would say, despite some of my misgivings about The Creator, I still think it's a damn good night at the movies. And I would see that on a big screen. And I'd then, you know, come home, have a little warm cocoa and watch Henry Sugar on Netflix.
Yeah, watch all of them.
Watch them all.
And it was great.
Yeah, there isn't a bad one in this. So what a great week. Brilliant. So before we go, though, we have time for a listener's question. And this is obviously somebody who's been miserable indoors. It's been raining so much recently. What's the best film involving umbrellas?
For me, it's probably going to be Singing in the Rain. I love that movie so much. I mean, all of the dance sequences, the singing. I mean, it's also just a very interesting movie about the business of movie making. And like, bonus is it gave us that Tom Holland lip sync challenge where he was doing Rihanna with kind of, oh, he starts off doing Singing in the Rain and then breaks into Rihanna. And I've watched that conservatively 10,000 times, and every time it brings me joy. So yeah, double umbrella goodness.
Yes, him in a sort of wet look outfit, wasn't it? And a wig. It's quite astonishing. Yeah, Singing in the Rain is a cracker, and it is the one you think of most. I'm going to go with Mary Poppins. I love her umbrella with the talking parrot handle, and the fact that she uses it as a mode of transport and sort of just glides out of the sky with her feet turned out to save the day and save children wherever she goes. Love that. And also, if we're talking about proper rain and rainy scenes, I love With Nell and I when it's absolutely peeing down in that field and they're sort of trying to get the farmer's attention. They don't have an umbrella. They just have plastic bags on their feet. But later at the very end of With Nell, we see With Nell himself with his umbrella in the rain doing Shakespeare to the wolves in Regent's Park. Love it. It's a classic. I haven't watched With Nell and I for ages. I think it's about time. Oh, having just seen
it really has aged so well. It just gets better and better. I read this amazing essay about how it was the ultimate breakup film, and it really is.
Oh yeah, he goes off with his job, he gets his job, and With Nell doesn't.
Love comes in many forms and ends in various ways, but yeah. Oh God, With Nell and I rewatch coming up for,
yes.
I think I do one about every 18 months. But
yeah, me too. I feel like I've seen Richard E. Grant in loads of films recently, and I'm always reminded, oh my God, he's so great. But the thing that he's the best in ever, and I don't think he's going to better it, is with Nell. He's just incredible in that. So that is Umbrellas. And for now, I think that's it. So it's time to say goodbye, Layla. So do say goodbye.
Goodbye.
Goodbye. You have my heart, and we'll never be one.